Cheers. First, I'd like to share with you all the song that I was inspired to write several years ago, inspired by the Bhagavatam. There's a story. After the demise of King Vena, who was a very merciless king and caused so much trouble, the earth was in a state of not producing. It wasn't producing because of out of fear for King Vena. And shortly afterwards, when King Vena was, life was taken away from him by the power of the Brahmanas, curse of the Brahmanas, Krishna made his appearance as King Prithu. And there's an exchange between King Prithu and the earth, who at the time was still not producing. And I remember reading it. At the time, this was, I think, maybe 1986, I was in Toronto, and it just so happened that it was Earth Day. And I didn't know anything about Earth Day at the time. It was probably the first year that I heard about it. So I was just inspired to write from this particular story. So it's called Song for Mother Earth. I'm going to plug in my advertising before the song. Afterwards, I want to keep some formality, but the song is recorded. I have it available on this CD here. So if you'd like to be interested, you can come and see me after the presentation. Thank you very much. As a cow gives milk out of affection for a calf, you supply the fields with fruits and flowers for beans. But now because ungodly ones have plundered all your wealth, I hear you calling out in desperation on your whom the Lord has called to death. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. No one can kill anyone whom the Lord wants to protect. The aroma of your generated by the heat. It's now contaminated with the experimental waste. The rivers and the lakes and ponds no longer do they meet with the need for water so desired in its purest state. Mother, you are overburdened all around your seven seas with the unnecessary defense forces ruling everything. What was once your luster is now turned into disease. The wars have scarred your face, but still I hear you loudly say, no one can protect the one whom the Lord has called to death. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. No one can kill anyone whom the Lord has come to protect. Now it seems the time has come to place the matter in your higher hands. Mother, you've taken on so much, though you haven't changed your ways. And all your godly children voice out throughout the lands the names of your creator, the liberator of your pain. Though it seems the sun has set, Mother Earth is laying. Golden age is taking birth in the womb of eternal time. The Almighty Lord has now descended in the sound of His holy name. Carry each and every one in the flood of love. No one can kill anyone whom the Lord wants to protect.
Please give a warm welcome to our son of honors.
For not producing. Bhumi has been through many ordeals. She was quite misunderstood by Preeti Maharaj, who, as a dutiful king in the mood of a loving father was concerned that his subjects appeared to be starving, and he saw it wasn't because they were lazy. They were performing their occupational duties in farming, and the earth just wasn't producing. So he took the initiative to chastise her, and she explained to him that I'm really being misunderstood. It's not that I don't want to produce, but the truth is that during the reign of cruel Vena, and under his influence, the population was pretty demoniac. And they were using my gifts for sense gratification. And that is not why I produce. And it's been so long, and my seeds to the roots and herbs and food, they're no longer fertile. So you have to supply an appropriate calf and cowherd boy. And then out of affection, I'll begin producing again. So we see from this example, and others also, as with Kali's entrance into this age, what do we first find him doing? Assaulting the legs of a cow and a bull. The cow being the representative of the earth, which you can also understand as a microcosm of the earth, or really a microcosm of the universe, where the earth is in between. There's that chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam which explains how the different types of oceans throughout the universe have different substances. There's an ocean of milk, an ocean of salt water, ocean of liquor. And the substance in the ocean tells what part of the body of the cow that is. The ocean of milk is her udder. The ocean of liquor is her stomach, where there's fermentation. The saltwater ocean is her urine. So, cow, emblematic of the earth. And who is her companion? Dharma, which we usually translate as religious principles. But in one wonderful shloka, Bhagavatam 1.16.18, Srila Prabhupada translates Dharma as morality. And I find this very significant, that in one place, the only place I know of, that Srila Prabhupada translated Dharma as morality, because as devotees, we've been given the highest knowledge. It's like, without any qualification or preparation, we've received a university diploma. There's so much knowledge. We haven't really gone through the subsequent classes and lessons, both in knowledge and in culture, in maturity, in relationships, to really assimilate all that knowledge. And sometimes we need to go back. And I say this in context of what I've experienced in approaching leaders in our movement with a concern that Srila Prabhupada's emphasis on farming, which is pretty synonymous with Varnashram Dharma, or you could say prerequisite to Varnashram Dharma, is not being prioritized. And when I hear responses like, well, what's the relevance? try to understand what happened over the years. Because a spiritual movement needs to be adaptable. It needs to express itself in ways that people are going to understand, appreciate, and receive its relevance. Otherwise it becomes irrelevant. Srila Prabhupada was way ahead of his time in the 60s and 70s. He was giving an ecological solution to a crisis for which the collective population of the earth was still in the denial stage. The crisis is one of collective addiction. And just like any addiction, it has its anatomy. In the initial stage of addiction, you don't want to confess, you don't want to admit. There's a refusal to tell the truth. That refusal develops into an inability to tell or acknowledge the truth. And how does the addiction develop? When we mistake, first it begins with a little overconsumption. And from that overconsumption, you get a taste for niceties. And then you mistake your niceties for necessities. That's the beginning of addiction. So we're all very well familiar with the crisis because the collective population of the earth is now coming out of the denial stage. And we're seeing there's a crisis. There's an ecological crisis on our hands. And what to do? So we're all pretty much aware of the melting ice caps and the diminishing rainforests and the most innocent, maternal gift of caring and love in which a mother nurses her baby has become the most concentrated form of toxic indulgence for the innocent one. We're all too aware of these things, so we don't need to dwell on those. And I would humbly request that we consider, rather than amongst the host of emotions, fear and anger, that would be part of the response to the atrocities inflicted upon the earth. And we should experience all of them in the process of grieving, but have the option of focusing our attention on gratitude, the thing that becomes the samikshamana. Because we're the recipients of an inconceivable blessing. To be born on this planet at this time, with the option to participate in the dance of life, with human consciousness, which alone is able to reflect upon the whole earth process, is a wonder beyond what words can express. And gratitude for the gift of life is the primary wellspring of all religions and hallmark of all mystics. Inspiration for great works of art. Problem is, that there's a tendency that the greatest gifts and blessings in creation, if they are readily and easily available, we tend to take them for granted. And even the holy name of the Lord, made readily and easily available by the unprecedented, unparalleled, inconceivable mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada, has also gone the way of many lesser wonders in this world. Because it's readily and easily available, and we tend to mistake that the holy name is produced by our own efforts, we take it for granted. And to demonstrate and contrast the ingratitude, which is characteristic of the conditioned soul, and the deep gratitude, which is the wellspring of spiritual tradition, Mahaprabhu, in heartfelt words and tear-filled eyes, calls out to the son of Nanda Maharaj in great anguish of heart, Etadashitava Kripa Bhagavan Mamabhi Durgayana Midushan Hajana Nanda Raja Adila Krishna. You have showered such inestimable blessings upon this earth, but I am so unfortunate. I have no attraction for that. Spiritual traditions begin with invocations of blessings, prayers, and expressions of thanksgiving, to remind us that for all its miseries and worries, our existence is a blessing worthy of deep reflection, humble contemplation, and devotional reciprocation. The present ecological crisis of this earth should not diminish that gratitude, but rather enhance it, because we've been offered an opportunity, a once-in-a-kalpa opportunity to be part of change, a turning and returning to the holistic and sustainable culture that Srila Prabhupada envisioned and instructed us to follow. To participate in that change, and even to survive upcoming generations, we need to access the deeper dynamics of life. So, I apologize, there are supposed to be slides, and on that technicality was not manifest. There was outlines that were supposed to be handed out, but due to some technological curse, I apologize that none of this came about. And even the title of the course got altered in such a way as it might have lost its initial intent. But since tomorrow's Mother's Day, I thought we should contemplate how to properly honor our Earth Mother, which is not simply some sweet rhetoric or poetic metaphor, but a substantial reality essential for our spiritual lives. Srila Prabhupada repeatedly emphasized that we cannot understand the Lord without His mercy. We cannot approach the Lord without His energies. We cannot understand the Lord or serve the Lord but through the agency energy. And his energies personify themselves as various consorts. And the consort of Lord Varaha, who saved the world in her previous ecological crisis, was Bhumi. So, this consort, or as the sages in the Srimad Bhagavatam glorify her as the wife of the Lord. That she has her own inherent, what I call, eco-ethical code. So what is ethics? It's a system of moral standards or values. What is ecology? It's a way of looking at the world in a more subjective and feeling way, with wonder, awe, and gratitude, and humility. And what is a code? It's a body of laws or set of principles or rules of conduct. And in the case of Mother Earth, she doesn't speak to us in English. She speaks to us through a set of symbols which come from the field of archetypes, which maintain communication between soma and psyche, between conscious and unconscious, between the individual and the world, between the human and the planet. And one of the most insidious effects of intoxication, to which we're all subject, whether we like it or not, because of the byproducts of industrial waste leaching into our soils, waters, and air, affecting our consciousness. And the syndrome of denial and repression, which numbs the pain which we all feel because of our connection with the whole. We feel the orphaned fawns whose mother never came back because she got hit by a car. We feel the crying of starving children in other countries on some level, but we tend to repress it and deny it because it's not our problem and we didn't create it. The problem is that along with repressing your pain and denying your responsibility and shutting out the cries of others' children, you also shut out the laughter and joys and feelings and needs of your own children. Along with burying your lies, you also cover your truths. And in denying your responsibility, you exempt yourself from the empowerment required to be part of the solution. So, we need to know our mother in order to understand who our father is, what is his nature, and our relationship to him. Otherwise, and also we need to understand our father to truly understand our mother, her personality, sanctity, personality, desire, and needs. If we don't understand these truths, we abuse and destroy her. She who is the womb and the tomb, and again the womb of everyone who lives on this planet. So, in addition to being our collective body, she's also our collective psyche as well. And destroying the unconscious mind of the planet through toxic overload and abusive behavior leaves us with less ability to acknowledge and understand and interpret and follow these symbols she sends to us, which would lead us out of darkness and into the light, out of the maze of material existence, onto the path of devotion, and out of a hellish existence into a healthy one. So, there's a term for this collective addiction to consumer goods. It's called affluenza. I looked it up in the dictionary, wondering if it actually existed. And to my utter amazement and wonder and pleasure, found that it is actually an acknowledged word in the dictionary. And the definition and example gives Srila Prabhupada's mission in a nutshell. Definition of affluenza: extreme materialism, which is the impetus for accumulating wealth and for overconsumption of goods. Also, feelings of guilt and isolation from the dysfunctional pursuit of wealth and goods. Example. This is from Webster's New Millennium Dictionary. Example. Affluenza is a social disease caused by consumerism, commercialism, and rampant materialism. And its antidote is simple living. Now, I would just add two words, because our Amish neighbors are perfect in simple living. Simple living and simple thinking. Plain living and plain thinking. But Srila Prabhupada added one more concept: plain living and high thinking. And this is where devotees have a sacred responsibility. We should be the forerunners in the ecological movement. Now, it's a matter of the tail wagging the dog, because other people are taking up the banner, but they don't have the means to get to the root cause of the problem, which is envy, which transforms and mutates into lust and greed and inconsiderateness and unkindness. So, why did Srila Prabhupada emphasize the farm movement, which he used pretty synonymously with Varnashram Dharma, which he said was the second half of his mission? And toward the end of his lila, he was headed for Gitanagari. And the words he used to explain why are so significant. He said, "I'm going there to sit down and teach how to live off the land." Why did he say sit down? It's not that farming is work for a lazy person. He said sit down because three characteristics of consumerism is narcissism, pragmatism, and chronic unrest. Narcissism, that's obvious. Pragmatism, it doesn't mean being practical, because Srila Prabhupada was the most practical. It means putting practicality for the sake of my narcissism above other principles of dharma and duty and relationships and caring and sharing and compassion. So Srila Prabhupada emphasized the farm movement for three basic reasons. Practical: it solves the problems of life, and material difficulties and complications and tribulations are minimized within a paradigm which allows us to decipher their meaningful and benevolent message. Now, in some climates, farm life is easy. You know, you work hard during the planting, and you work hard during the harvest, and the rest of the year you have lots of spare time. That doesn't apply in all climates, in all conditions. In this climate, it's considered to be hard work. It just never ends. So why did Srila Prabhupada emphasize it? Because it's the noble occupation. It's not working hard as ugra karma in a condition, in a culture which is vikarma, that has no meaning, no purpose. It's very meaningful, it's very purposeful for an ashram. So, practical purpose. And why does it minimize the difficulties, tribulations, and complications of life? Because it's done for the pleasure of Krishna. And that minimizes the reactions. In vikarma, activity that's, you know, goes against the principles of karma. Every action creates many reactions which just multiply. For example, the convenience of using a car instead of walking or taking a horse creates so many reactions. Plundering economies to mine the various metals, smelting factories, rubber factories, factory workers, smog, pollution, destroying the life symptoms of the planet, ultimately. Just for that one little convenience. And it's not even a convenience. It's an illusion. But anyway, that's the beauty. That's why Srila Prabhupada emphasized Vanashram Dharma. Living according to Krishna's plan. It may be hard work, and purification is always a challenge. But it's meaningful, it's uplifting, it's pleasing to Krishna, and it's not have the endless reactions that just entangle us and ensnare us and bind us in material existence. And the more you struggle to get free, the more entangled you become. Varnashram Dharma is the other way. The more you strive to please Krishna, the more you are relieved from the reactions which bind us to this material world and uplifted. So that's the practical. The spiritual reason Srila Prabhupada emphasized Varnashram, which I use synonymously with the far movement, is it facilitates satyagraha. And the practical, the outreach, it sets an example. It offers the only cause, the only solution to the root cause of ecological crisis. So, these are some of the... And farm life necessitates cooperation, whereas industrial life fuels the fire of competition. When people live off the land, commute properly, in the right mood, community develops naturally. As people move away from the land, community fades. So modern life in today's world features a displaced priority. And Srila Prabhupada wanted to correct that imbalance. So then, what has been the plight of farm communities? Some of which, like New Vrindavan and Gijanagan, got off to very good beginnings. It came to crash and halt. We used to think that farm life necessitates you have some farmers, you have some experience, you have some land, you have the equipment and the draft animals, the oxen and the horses, and you offer training, and people become attracted and take up that lifestyle. And then we found out that it wasn't quite that simple, because one appeal was what I call a romantic one. It's like the novelty of alternative lifestyles. So in that novelty stage, which is like romance, it's very appealing, but then you realize that this is hard work. And it's like marriage. In marriage, there's an infatuation period where whatever faults the other party has are just seen as the most beautiful embellishments in their character. And at a certain point, that ends. And everything about the person just can't stand. And what carries you through that transitional phase? Commitment. And what does commitment create? Character. Compassion. Sharing in the joys and the agonies of another's life nurtures compassion, which otherwise you might not develop. So, but then, okay, so some of it made it through the romance stage. And they developed a taste. Most of those who had that taste early in their life, but a few others developed it later on. And then we came crashing into another invisible roadblock. And it took me years to get some understanding of what that was. It is the eternal conflict between the divine and demoniac nature, which is stated in Bhagavad Gita 16, 13 through 15. The demoniac person thinks, so much wealth I have today, and so much more I will attain tomorrow according to my schemes. So much is mine now. He is my enemy, and I've killed him, and my other enemies will also be killed. I am the Lord of everything. I am the enjoyer, perfect, powerful, and happy. I am the richest man surrounded by aristocratic relatives. There is no one so powerful and happy as I am. I shall perform sacrifices, give charity, and thus shall rejoice. And Krishna concludes, in this way, such persons are deluded by ignorance. Now that's a very blatant demoniac mentality that we find very distasteful. What we don't realize is until we have our own self-reliant farm communities, we are sharing foundations with that demoniac culture through four cornerstones: educational, economic, media, and medical. And the exchange, the influx, the infiltration, subtly, the indoctrination, the contamination, the toxic influence of the demoniac mentality seeps in to our communities through these different cornerstones if we share them. And that's why Srila Prabhupada emphasized, first grow your own food. And then he also emphasized Gurukula. Because what is the basic ethic of modern educational system, which Srila Prabhupada called the slaughterhouse of education? You do not have any inherent gifts, qualities, or abilities to make it on your own. You have to come to us for training and education so that we can employ you in meaningful occupation, so you can maintain yourself and your family. That stands in stark contrast to the message of Arnashram, which you all have inherent gifts, a vocation given by Krishna to be recognized by the elders and the wiser of the community and encouraged, and it becomes fun for children to experience, to develop the practice of vocation. You see children growing up on farms. Everything is an adventure. You see children growing up in the city on these video games where things are going 1,000 miles an hour. Or you go to a movie. Media. You go to the movie. First of all, you have to turn out the lights. First, we have to enter into total darkness, and then the movie comes on the screen. And in somewhere between, I've never been, but I guess, what are they, an hour and a half to 3 hours, something like that. In that period of time, you attain the perfection of life. You conquer over all your enemies, and all your violence is gratified by some sexual encouragement and glorification. And in 3 hours, by the time the lights go on, come on, you've conquered over all impediments and attained perfection. And then you look at the person sitting next to you, and you don't like the way they act, and they're moving so slow, and they're not doing everything that you believed was your inherent right during that last 3 hours, and you get so frustrated, and then suddenly you wonder why people just go out and shoot everybody sometimes for moving so slow and not cooperating. They see that in the media. They think that's what they're supposed to do. You're indoctrinating them to do this, and when they do, you wonder what was wrong with that person. Whereas farm life teaches patience, cooperation. Srila Prabhupada said, we need to have a place to demonstrate how man can live in harmony with nature, in harmony with men, in harmony with animals, in harmony with the devas, all focused on the center, Krishna's pleasure. So, consumerism is a collective addiction. It awards to the status, it exalts industrialization to the status of religion, mission, patriotism, and rewrites history in mythic terms. What does myth mean? It's something, it's a story, usually of an unknown author, ostensibly with historical basis, but serving usually to explain some phenomena of nature. And it has its own customs, institutions, religious rites. Under the influence of the addiction to consumer goods and its toxic byproducts and influence, we believe that this is the proper way to live. And we live in the first world country. Because, well, various reasons, but there's only one world. What's the first world? And what's the third world countries? The third world countries are those who had all their resources exploited by the greed of those in the first world countries. So, to fulfill its desire, the all-consuming need of an addiction will sacrifice everything. Children, home, relationships, religion. The planet's very life support system, which is called geocide. It's pathological. It's suicidal. And when it's unchecked, it leads to death, as does any addiction. If an addiction does not lead to death, it's usually because of a crash. When the person was confronted with the reality of imminent death, if he did not dramatically change his ways. Unfortunately, a crash at the present speed of our plundering economy is one from which the world probably would not be able to recover with much dignity as long as human beings survived. Unless there is a change of consciousness. And that's why Srila Prabhupada said that's the second half of his mission. So, in the stages of addiction, there's loss of identity. Now, we're talking about false ego. I mean, false ego being identity. False ego is meaningful because it carries certain frustrations that lead us largely from various things, you know, social interactions, symbolic messages from the subconscious, they're all guiding us from, you know, the false self to the real. But when there's a split between the false self and itself, and you enter into a double illusion, you can't decipher the messages that would lead you back to the right path. So, and that also means you can't interpret the message that your own body is sending you. And you get some pain, and you take some pills, and the pain goes away. And you think that was the cure. You never contemplate, what is my body trying to tell me? And then the body develops more and more ways to try to bring your attention to a certain point. And you take more and more drugs with more and more side effects, and more drugs to suppress the side effects. And then your children, who are learning from your behavior, think that they're machines too. And the malady deepens with successive generations until somebody takes sufficient responsibility to stop it. So what does it mean when we say the earth is our mother? There's a wonderful description in the Garga Samhita of Uddhava's visit to Vrindavan, because Krishna wanted him to see firsthand what real love is, which is not found in Mathura to the degree and the depth and the sweetness of this Braj. And ultimately, Krishna was preparing Uddhava through seeing the Vrindavasis in their separation from Krishna, accompanying Krishna on his return to Braj, and seeing him in the ecstasy of union with Krishna. He was preparing Uddhava to later go to Bhadragashram and from there to proclaim that Braj Bhakti to the world. But anyway, you know, after seeing the cows and the cowherd boys and the intense separation of Nanda and Yashoda, Uddhava was realizing that his thinking that he was the best devotee, which was true in Mathura, was put before a background where he didn't feel like he was a devotee at all. He was very uneasy to meet the gopis. But when they saw the chariot before Nanda's door the next morning, and then, who is this boy wearing Krishna's own garments and garland? It looks just like, and he crowded around. And Srila Prabhupada said, the unsophisticated village girls, he surrounded them. And he realized it was going to be very difficult to convey Krishna's message to them. He first began glorifying the gopis, and in his glorification of Srimati Radharani, he revealed a wonderful truth about our earth mother. Uddhava began enumerating the diverse forms in which Srimati Radharani accompanies Krishna in his various avatars, both direct and empowered. He said, when the Lord appears as Narayan, you are Lakshmi. When he expands as Shiva, you are Parvati. And the gopis, hearing their beloved friend glorified in this way, experienced a sense of wonderment and expanded love. She's Mahalakshmi? That did not diminish their love for her, but enhanced their appreciation of our gopi friend. Uddhava continued, when the Lord appears as Varaha, you are Bhumi. When he appears as Narada, You are his Veena. When he appears as Narayan Rishi, you are peace. When he appears as Kapila, you are the mystic perfections. When he appears as Prithu, you are Archie. When he appears as Matsya, you are the Vedas. When he appears as Dhanvantari, you are the medicinal herbs. And when he appears in the future as Parashuram, you will be his axe. So, from the words of Uddhava, we can see that it's not just some sentiment that the earth is a goddess. Even the ecological people, they understand she's a living entity, she's a goddess. We have the actual understanding, which means that her ways and her ethics is preparing us here in our homeland to return to our eternal home, which is why Earth's ways and Earth ethics are so important to understand and honor. In Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary to Krishna's adventures in Mathura, he explains that when Krishna saw Kubja and he called out to her, "Oh, beautiful lady," well, she was a hunchback. What does he mean? He was seeing her potential, not her present condition. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Kubja is Prithvi, Bhumi. And she was a hunchback because of the heavy burden on her shoulders of the unnecessary defense force of demons who were posing as Kshatriyas, who were supposed to protect the earth, but were rather exploiting her. And of course, in the conversation between Prithu and Bhumi, as we discussed, she is explaining how it's out of affection that I produce sustenance for my children. And what evokes her affection? When they're using her gifts for Krishna's pleasure in his service. And there's a wonderful conversation in... What time are we supposed to end? 6:15? In Mahabharata, Shanti Parva, when Maharishi Yudhisthira is inquiring from Bhishma, and he asks, "What is the highest virtue?" And Bhishma says, "Kindness." Bhishma, this is what Kshatriyas are supposed to embody. Kindness, protection, caring. Bhishma said, "Kindness." And then he told him a story. He said, there was one sage, Jadali, who had long matted hair. And he would perform tapasya in the water for a long time and stand perfectly still, so still that two Kalinga birds made nests in his hair. And he was thinking, "I don't want to disturb them by moving, so I'll be perfectly still." So the Mataji bird laid eggs, and they hatched, and the little birds never suspected that they were living in somebody's hair. It was like a, not even like a tree that sways, it was like a post that never moved. So they felt very secure. And then the little birds grew up feeling protected. And then they started to fly a little bit, you know, first for half a day, and then for a few days, and for a few months. After they stayed away from the nest for 6 months, Jajali concluded that they'd grown up and left the nest. Now I can move. And then he proclaimed that there was just no limit to my merit for the sake to offer shelter to those little birds. I performed this great tapasya of standing so still for 6 months, longer really, considering before the eggs hatched. And then a voice from the sky said, "Your merit cannot compare to that of Tuladhar in Varanasi, who, although a very humble merchant, is so exalted, but even he does not have the right to boast the way that you just did." And then he got angry. "Who is this Tuladhar? envy, he proceeded straight to Varanasi. And he's going through the market. How am I going to find him? And this merchant stood up and approached him, very excited, kind, loving, and hospitable, and said, "I've been waiting for you, my dear friend, gentlemen. My name is Tuludar." "Well, how do you know I was coming?" He said, "Well, I have that power of intuition. Because I practice this virtue of kindness, and then the Lord reveals to me everything I need to know." And then Tuludar began extolling to Jatani the virtues of kindness. He said, generally, it's considered that farming is the most noble occupation because it demonstrates harmony with the natural order. But it's actually not the perfection. Even higher is yoga, meaning union with the Lord to such an extent that you will not even participate in the violence of plowing, because it injures other living entities. The little insects in the soil, they get injured and killed. So that's not the highest. The highest is perfect kindness. And gently said, "Well, how could people what's their sustenance if nobody's farming?" And he said, "If the citizens came to such a standard of virtue that they would not consider harming one another, the earth, out of affection, would produce ample grains and other forms of foodstuffs without even being cultivated, just out of affection. Because she's a cow. A cow produces milk, or the term in the earth, just all varieties of our sustenance out of affection. Naturally. But this is Kali Yuga. And you can make vegetables and grains with tractors," which came after World War II, where there's so much industry. Well, there's no more need for tanks, we have tractors. And what do you do with all these explosives? Well, high explosives is ammonium nitrate. It's fertilizer treated with diesel fuel. So put the diesel fuel in the tractor, put the ammonium nitrate in the ground. You don't taste like anything. You can't tell the difference between the different crops if you don't see them, because they all taste so bland. They're actually artificial. They're just chemicals that look like vegetables and grains. And they're not produced out of affection of the earth. They're produced out of artificial exploitation. But nevertheless, whatever his name was that came up with the system of farming is so highly praised in this world for saving millions of lives by his agricultural revolution, which in just a few short years kills the soil so it can't grow anything. Aided by the tractor, compacting everything. Toxic waste at every step. Contrast this to ox power. Dharma. In the field. Cultivating your sustenance, enriching every step with manure, which is it's magical. It just converts even that farmed out soil back into rich, fertile land again. Non-toxic, beneficial at every step, and they reproduce, not oxen, but bulls. When we were farming in the old days, not the old days, the intermediate days, when we still had half animal power and half tractor power, I was amazed at the contrast in consciousness when you go from a team to a tractor. When you're operating a tractor thinking, "What's that sound? Is that a rod bearing going? I'm going to have to send to Germany for parts. How am I going to get the money?
and I had to shut this thing down at maybe the critical stage of cultivation or harvest. And your mind gets so disturbed with all these worst-case scenarios and complications. When you part that, take out a team of oxen. I think, and of course the tractor dies at some point and becomes toxic waste. The animals, they've reproduced themselves maybe 30 times, 25 times by the time they die. And when they die, they're still nourishing the earth. And what's going to go wrong? Maybe a horse throws a shoe. Well, you go down to the forge and make a new one. Everything's local. Local economies are not overexploited. Multinational corporations overexploit, leaving third world countries where others are starving to gratify our gluttony in the first world countries. And whereas there was only one Tower of Babel in the days of yore, there was two just a few years ago. So what happened when they came crashing down? What did our illustrious leader tell us to do? Contemplate? Grieve those who died? Pray for guidance? No. Keep shopping. I was living on a mountain down in Maryland one time, out in the middle of nowhere. And then, you know, one year I came back after being gone, and I saw an army truck driving. I didn't know there was a road down the valley. An army truck drove up. It drove up to the side of the mountain and stopped. What is going on? Then he showed some papers to the guy at the gate. The gate opened and drove inside the mountain. I said, what are they doing in there? And then I found out that that's where all the, you know, the president and his ministers go if there's war. They go under this mountain. What do they do there? They go shopping. That's the intoxication. But unfortunately, it doesn't just affect them. The toxic waste of that overindulgence seeps into the soils and the waters and airs that we all share. So, and anyway, that's kindness, compassion, harmony. Why did Srila Prabhupada tell us on Radhastami that Srimati Radharani was born in the furrow? Now, most Gaudiya Vaishnavas understand that she was born in the lotus. Srila Prabhupada said she appeared in the furrow. He was word for word the appearance of Sita Devi with the names changed. And what? Why? And then he found out that in other millenniums she appears in that way. Why did Srila Prabhupada tell that version? Instead of the version that almost all their Gaudiya Vaishnavas accept. They're both true for the various millenniums. Consider the sacramental aspect of plowing. The plow is the emblem of regeneration. The furrow is opening the womb of the earth to plant the seed, which she offers back as her fruit for our sustenance. That's a whole sacramental, and that's why, and why was Janak Maharaj plowing? Because Ravana had spread blood in his fields and they weren't producing. So to counteract that contamination, the king himself is plowing the field. The Sita, whose name means furrow, appeared. When Bhumi and Dharma, the cow and the bull, are taken out of the field and sent to places we would not mention, and their manure is not going back in, what goes back? Blood meal and bone meal. Which means that even your vegetables are not vegetarian. So if you want to maintain a pure lifestyle, consider working towards our own farms. So, and in other traditions, consider the role of the earth goddess. In Hebrew tradition, highly patriarchal, which is all right as long as the feminine is not eliminated. But when father eliminates mother, he's hard to live with. And therefore his name was so secretive. The Hebrews understood that, you know, there's a relation between the Lord and his name. But considering their concept of God, they kept it secret. That name would invoke that presence, and considering his nature, better to keep a healthy distance from him. So in the Bhavishya Purana, it's explained, I forget the king's name, Himalaya saw an effulgent personality in white robes, and like, who are you? He said, I'm Ishaputra, son of a virgin. What's your mission? Oh, to lead the Mlechas and teach them the chanting of the holy name. So, Mary, in Western tradition, fulfills and amplifies the function of all the previous earth goddesses, who were mythological. But even mythology has its role. It's the way the archetypes speak through symbols to give us some sense of meaning and purpose and direction in life. Krishna consciousness is the most pure form of symbology. And Srila Prabhupada, you know, he kind of minimized symbology because he didn't want us to take Krishna Lila as symbolic. It's not symbolic, it's the absolute truth, but it's very rich in symbology. So, in this way, the earth goddess is she facilitates, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has been my pundit. When Mother Sachi came to understand that he's going to leave home, how can he leave? I lost my other son to the Sannyas order. My husband went back to Vaikuntha. How can you leave me? And for the longest time, Nimaya just sat with his head down. He could not even look at Mother Sachi. He couldn't say anything. Her anguish was so deep. Her body became pale and emaciated. So thin. And the Lord, finally with tear-filled eyes, looked up and said, Mother Sachi, you're not losing me. Don't you understand? You are always my mother. When you were Krishna, I became Krishna Garba, appearing from your womb. When you were Aditi, I became Vamana. You're always my mother. But in this Leela, you are my mother in two forms. You are the earth goddess who gives birth to my deity. And you are the tongue from whom appears my other form as the holy man. So, Vedic culture is somewhat matriarchal, but it reveres the feminine. Gaudiya Vaishnav culture is highly more reveres the feminine. But what we have in the industrial world is a pathological patriarchal. Consider abortion, which is an unfortunate reality that occurs when, due to loss of culture, men become irresponsible in their reproductive abilities. It's the woman who has to make the choice, usually coerced by men, to go to a clinic which is very lucrative for mostly male staff. Could it be that it's not a patriarchal society? This is not masculine, but this is a pathological masculine in which because sacrifice to Vishnu must be performed, otherwise our activities bind us more and more in material existence. Sacrifice must be performed. Sacrifice should be performed for the pleasure of Krishna. Otherwise it will be performed in such a way as entangles us more and more in material existence. Without sacrifice, there will be a dark manifestation of that missing element. And could it be that the missing sacrificial altar becomes the table? The missing sacrificial priest becomes the doctor? The missing sacrificial victim becomes the child? And we revert it back. Before Jesus came to put an end to the animal slaughter, before animal sacrifice was human sacrifice, and in the name of progress, because we wanted that car, so we didn't have to walk. The cars make everything far apart. And your occupation, for which you had to go to the institution, which said you don't have any vocation, will train you. For what? To be cogs in the corporate wheel. To make automobiles and airplanes for convenience. But you have to go wherever we send you. Wherever there's need for the exploitation. All over the world, you're going to get sent at any time. What happens to tradition? Where do boys learn from their fathers and grandfathers? Where are the shamans and brahmins who are the voice of tradition, who make God's people from the past present in the sound of their mantras, their instructions, providing right of entry or samskaras to assure individuals of the support of a tradition through the various stages of life, from birth to death and everything in between, marriage, everything. There's a support of tradition. Generations are living locally, generation after generation. The wisdom of the elders guides the youth. That car and that airplane and that occupation makes everything far away. And you're always in new association, people you don't know. Where's the elders? Where's the tradition? Where's the support of the family institution? And the children are terrified by the fear of orphanism. They're so terrified, they don't even realize it, because they've learned from their parents the art of repression and denial, to numb the pain, to bury their garbage dumps, to cover their toxic waste, to deny their guilt, to suppress their shame, because we're all participating in this plundering economy, which is holding our mother hostage to exploit her. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada taught us that The earth is our mother. Cows are mother. Cows are microcosm for the universe. In between is the earth. The generations of mothers. Who's her companion? Dharma, morality, relationships. You know, pine trees have a shallow root system. How do those redwoods, which are kind of like pine trees, shallow root system, they grow hundreds of feet tall. How do they stand in the winds? Shallow root system, but they're interlocked. There's support. So, and why is it that abortion, child abuse have become epidemics? Could it be because we're aborting the very life of the planet? If our mother's being abused, how can the children be protected? Therefore, Srila Prabhupada emphasizes Vamashram Dharma. So, what can we, the Hare Krishnas, who have not done very well in creating sustainable farm communities, do? And, you know, what is our role in the ecological crisis? We have, confronting this reality is daunting to the mind. It just makes the head spin and the heart palpitate and the spirit shrink. It's such a daunting task at hand. But Varnashram Dharma is aimed at the pleasure of Krishna. I'm the root of all existence. Everything emanates from me. The wise who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. The demons also know this. That's why they first assault Brahminical culture, which is based on cow protection and Brahman's guidance. That's why Kali was first detected striking at the legs of the cow and the bull. That's why Hiranyakashipu instructed his demons, attack the cow sheds, the brahmanas, the sacrificial altars, destroy those, because the demons can't take over. Why did the British first have to undermine faith in the sanctity of the cows and the brahmanas before they could subjugate India? They knew that the faith of the Vedic followers was so powerful, they could not control. And why conquer? So you can control, exploit, and manipulate according to your whims. You can't do that to people who have faith, the Brahminical culture. And what the cow and the bull symbolize. The sustenance of our mother. The protection of our father. So, it necessitates a paradigm shift. We always say, Krishna in the center, how much do we mean it? How much do we practice it? Because Krishna's pleasure is the basis of our spiritual progress, which also means empowerment. If we really want to please Srila Prabhupada, then in one place he said, therefore I'm asking so much here, and what is it? Farm, 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 farm. That's my program. Krishna's program. That's a quote. Srila Prabhupada spoke it in Vrindavan. He said, produce greenness everywhere. Everywhere Vrindavan. If it has taken your brain, then you can do it. You'll be able. Unquote. And I would add, by Krishna's grace, by Srila Prabhupada's mercy. We need to connect with the deeper dynamics of life if we are. diagram of our time schedule. Kind of off. But this is the earth, and it's also the brain. So the left side is the west, which is more patriarchal, more calculated, grosser, the cognitive functions. The right side is the east, more feminine, more subtle, intuition, compassion, feeling, mysticism. That's where we receive news regarding the condition of the planet in our relationship with her. When the left brain, which has this propensity to dominate, control, and dictate to the right side, we lose that ability to interpret the message. The earth is sending us from the field of archetypes, from the language of symbols, to understand our proper relationship with her, by which we can re-enter into grace with our Father. So, some advocate a 12 steps program, which is divinely inspired and is helpful for those who do not have such a tangible faith in Krishna, that we have to admit that we're powerless over the forces of an addicted society, which is so heavily fortified to protect its vital interests, with missiles pointing everywhere to convince us the problem's out there, it's not in here. We're powerless. Therefore, we come to acknowledge the existence of a power greater than ourselves, that if allowed, will reveal to each and every one of us our natural relationship to ourselves, to others, to other species, to the earth and creation. Examine ourselves, listing all attitudes and actions that damage the creative order. Confess, not only to yourself, because secrets spoken privately remain secrets. Confess to another and to the Lord that we are part of this problem, and become willing through humility to have all habits of illusion removed from our thoughts, attitudes, and behavior. Humility. Sharanagati. Krishna says it all. Sarva dharma prajata mamekam sharanam. Braja. Braja is a verb which means to go. Where to go? Braj. But it's very important to contemplate what is Krishna actually saying. Abandon all varieties of religion. What does he mean? Does he mean you can forget ethics and morals? Isn't that what religion's all about? You can ascend to the mode of goodness without religion, but you cannot do it without ethics and morals. So if you think that Krishna saying abandon all varieties of religion means you don't have to transcend the need for ethics and morals, think again. You don't have the need for ethics and morals when you become a pure devotee, and you can't do anything to harm others in thought, word, or deed. Until then, you need ethical codes to guide you in doing right, not doing wrong to others. But Krishna says you can abandon all varieties of religion, meaning the rituals that we tend to be so proud of and think that they are saving us. It's not the rituals. And we have to do everything in our power to heal the damage that we've done. And continue examining our thinking and actions as to whether they foster or impede the continuation of life. And through spiritual discipline, continue to try to improve our ability to foster the health and well-being of the entire created order. And having done all of those other things, to spread the message. Our movement has done very well at preaching. It has not done very well at providing the example of what we preach in regards to Varnashram Dharma. That is the second half of Srila Prabhupada's mission, which he bequeathed to us as our duty. But an institution has to adapt to the times to be relevant so as not to become irrelevant. It may be that in the present time and circumstance, we are not able to demonstrate how cow protection solves all our necessities of life. But we can demonstrate how cow protection provides the ethical example, which will, in time, if followed, lead to the solution of all problems of life. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Or anything anyone would like to add? Yes. That's the one question I always dread. It's the most important question, and it's the most desirable follow-up. His question is, what can we do now practically to follow up on everything we've just discussed? I was so inspired to hear that Hare Krishna Dasi's son. Is there anybody who'd like to explain that? What he's done? Anybody here would like to explain what he's done in the Congo? I'm not all that familiar with it. You'd like to explain what to me? She's going to explain because she's more familiar with it than I am, and this is an example of what one individual did.
We'll try it again.
Because
nope. Forget it.
He was born into this movement, raised in Gitanagari, and what he learned there, he carried into action because he saw an opportunity. And he acted upon it. He took the initiative. And I'm not all that familiar with.
Mother is involved in Food for Life Global, and through some other devotees association and everything, we've been involved in helping promote what's called Working Villages International. We had a meeting with, his name is Asto Parasata, otherwise known as Asto. His Hare Krishna Dasi son, you know, may know her. She writes for Back to Godhead for many years. And it's an amazing example of where to go from here now. He basically, he's 25 years old, just, you know, a young boy, and he was an economics major in college, and he wrote his graduation thesis paper on, basically he took his economics from Srila Prabhupada, from Gandhi, and one other person I don't remember the name of, basically simple living, high thinking, and his premise was that the reason our farm communities and other things didn't work out is because we didn't have a proper economic model, like a practical economic model, that we had the idea to live simply and to think high, but we didn't, you know, when it comes down to paying your bills and getting things, how do you make that work? So we were always going on. So anyways, he did his thesis on this, and it was really interesting. He was telling us that the professors, there were three professors that had to pass him, and all of them fought him tooth and nail, saying this is not possible, it won't work, this and that and the other thing. And finally, he actually won all of them over. They had to pass him because it was so logical, and it's just simple, 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 simple. So then he wanted to try his economics thesis out in real life. So he went to Africa, the most challenged place in the world, and he went to the Congo, which is one of the most challenged places on the earth. And actually, in America, we only probably don't even know about it, but over 5 million people were slaughtered there, just through civil unrest and, you know, Western forces giving everyone guns and stuff. I think we had an hour of news coverage total on it. Anyhow, so he went there and looking for a place to start this place. And usually people were begging from him, but one man came and gave him a basket of oranges and said, thank you. He thought he was lieutenant for the UN. He said, thank you, you know, for coming and checking on us, lieutenant. So he said, okay, I'll start here. And the government gave him a big grant of land, you know, to do this on, and basically started employing people. And I encourage all of you to write down the website. It's called Working Villages International. Go there and see his website, and you can read his economic thesis. It's an 80-page paper. So basically, in a nutshell, long story short, it's been, I guess, 3-4 years now, but he started off with just a handful of paid workers and using heirloom seeds, you know, barren land. He said when he went there, there wasn't even a bug or a snake or a bird or anything, because people were just eating everything they could, because there wasn't any food or anything, just guns and war. So now, just in last month of April, I wish my mother was here, she knows all the figures, but they've produced an astounding amount of rice, actually more than the entire country, just with a handful of people. They started, I think, with 20 workers, and then they had 100 workers, and now, just in the last month, it's doubled. There's like 400 workers, and they're making their own buildings, they're producing more food than they know what to do with. We were fortunate, we were able to give some donation, because they have a problem that you can't buy gasoline. It's $12 a gallon, so you know, that's like a year's salary. They can't transport the food and grains and everything. So his economic model is that instead of having currency, you have currency based on your own grain production. So you trade in rice, and it's very exciting. Please go in there and read. I don't know all the things, but basically the result has been that not only that the, and it's really interesting too, just as an aside, kind of a joke. When he first got there, he said he wanted to have 50% of the workers female, and the male said, well, females don't even know how to use a wheelbarrow, so, you know, you won't have any luck there. But then he said, by empiric evidence, it has been proven that females do indeed know how to use a wheelbarrow. But so, and he had hired people from many different villages or tribes. So right now, and everybody's like, well, hey, why did you start in that village? Why not our village? He said, well, because when we're done with your village, this village, we're coming to yours. And it's basically fostered such a mood of loving cooperation there that, you know, everybody's behind them. And even there was a big warlord there who's like a big bully. He came there. Well, before that story was interesting, the police chief took Asto into custody and was basically saying, you know, unless you give me such and such money, I'm going to destroy you. And within moments or minutes of him being taken by the corrupt police chief, all of the workers and their families surrounded the police station and basically said, if you don't release him immediately, we will kill you and your entire family. So the police chief said, aye, aye. Because they understand what it means for them. It means a home, it means unlimited amount of food, it means a way of life, it means a hope and a future. And everybody's buying into it because they're seeing that right now, this used to be the most barren place. At one time, it was the rice bowl of whole Africa. And then after the West came and plundered and exploited and raped the earth, then it was just horrible. So now he came again introducing these simple principles, and this is like, where do we go from here now? And it's not like he was just trying to do it to make some African charity. There's so much African charity. But actually to teach them a way of life that's sustainable, they can do. And it's a prototype, so that when this is working, it's not completely self-sufficient yet because there's still funds coming from the West going there. But the idea is that when they get to a certain level of production and trade amongst themselves, then it just pulls out and it just keeps going. And then they can do it again. So that's the idea. But please go there and check it out. We were fortunate. We were able to go in a Working Villages International. If you go to Food for Life website, it's on the front page. There's a link to that. We gave some money for donation for oxen. They bought 8 oxen, and they're going to be trained soon, hopefully with voice command and everything. And they're forbidden to eat them. Unfortunately, none of them are devotees, so he's trying to import a Brahmin there to encourage people to somehow rather understand Krishna consciousness. But, I mean, there's some really wild stories. Oh, and then the warlord one, I think this is really interesting. This warlord came there, and again, something similar with the police chief. He wanted to, you know, say, here, you know, I'm going to take over here, and this and that and the other thing. And not only the villagers and the people who were working for him, but all of the other, the tribe of kings, you know, the king's council or whatever they call it, there they all came together and said, you're going down. You leave him alone or else. And so he also stepped back because people understand what's happening. So this is very, 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 very exciting. It's a 25-year-old guy, you know, he just out of college with a heart of gold. And I'm so excited about it. So, I mean, again, I was talking to Marge the other day, and I also don't. I live in the city. Where do we go from here? Do I go to the Congo? What do I do, you know? Do I start farming my backyard, get a miniature cow? What do I do? Start walking on the beltway.
We have a precious example in that story, because this is a 25-year-old boy who took birth in our movement from Hare Krishnadasa, who was inspired by Paramananda, who left here to go start Idanagari. So Srila Prabhupada understood that he was planting seeds in his life for a future eventuality, not all of which he would see in that lifetime. And by Krishna's grace, his preaching spread like wildfire, influencing devotees to join the movement. But when you're talking about reviving or recreating a culture, that takes time. Srila Prabhupada said at a certain point in his mission that now we have enough devotees. Rather than concentrate on making more devotees, we have to use different analogies. Boiling the milk. Meaning, develop the culture loving exchanges of devotee care. Because when devotees feel protected and valued, now value is something you can learn from the animals. You know, cows, animals are very aware of humans' attitudes towards them. So cows are happy when they're giving milk, which they know is being appreciated by the humans and they're being valued. What do you do with oxen? Just put them out in pasture to graze? They're not happy. They don't feel valued because they're very much aware of whether they're contributing to society and being valued in return. That applies to humans also. It applies to the culture of loving relationships, which Srila Prabhupada is referring to, in terms of, we don't need to make more devotees now, we need to take care of those we have. Develop the loving relationships that devotees will feel protected, valued, appreciated, and then you see the empowerment to do all the things you were pushing and exploiting them to do, and you may have achieved those results, but they're not sustainable because they're empty, hollow, and shallow. if not produced in a way that is pleasing to Krishna, who wants all his parts and parcels appreciated and engaged. So, anyway, we have this wonderful example. Sorry, got off the track there, but so this is a boy who was raised in one of our farm communities, Giriagra. He was born into this culture, a farm life in the Hare Krishna movement. And then when in the Congo, by mistake, when a man brought him some oranges thinking that he was a UN worker who came out to do his duty, because the UN workers don't come out to do their duty. So this man saw him and thought that's what he was. He was so appreciative, gave him oranges, and that's not who he was or why he was there. But he saw this as Krishna's arrangement. And he took it up. And he did something revolutionary. And we have examples now. Purushottam Maharaj in Brazil gave a presentation. I was so impressed. I told him, Maharaj, you're doing all the right things for all the right reasons. America, North America, is more difficult because this is the very heart of the plundering economy. It's more formidable. It's more difficult. So we have examples elsewhere in the world that are working. And it's just a matter of adopting those principles and applying them in America. So where we can go from here, I would suggest that anyone interested in contributing to the farm movement, contact those who are already involved. Dr. Punj Prabhu has a marvelous training program. He networks with others. And we form a network so that we can keep in touch, because what I've observed is that the earthlings and farmers in our movement tend to be scattered and stay scattered by Maya's arrangement, lest they come together and unite and achieve something glorious through communication. Keep in touch. Appreciate whatever anybody is doing in this direction. Encourage, facilitate, and it will grow. And just like Hare Krishnadasi's son, I can't remember his name, he was born into this movement. So he's like a seed who's gone out and taken root. And much of what we want to achieve, we may not see in this lifetime, but we can plant the seeds, we can cultivate. Well, I can say something in that regard, that, you know, we used to have a lot of Amish people come here because they wanted to buy horses from me, because I'm well known in Amish country as being, you know, somebody who raises and trains quality draft animals. So, you know, we had very difficult challenges for the draft animals in the early days. They had to do the locking on the sides of cliffs, so they had to learn how to sidestep at such an angle that, you know, these huge timber logs wouldn't just take them over the cliff. Very precision work. So I would train them up to a standard that they could get the work done. And they appreciated that so much, they just started figuring out how to come to a higher standard on their own. Just taking great pride and delight in pleasing their master. And it is a great honor to be able to train animals, draft animals for Krishna service, because they become your teachers, and you become a student with so much to learn. And this can help us understand that our earth is not only mother, she's teacher. Her ways prepare us for our eternal homeland. The outlines just arrived, which we're going to follow through this class, by the loving hands of the professor of time himself, Shankar Nandabhu. Some of us used to be very calculating, thinking that if things didn't happen on time, they wouldn't work out. And he has taught us that Krishna is time, and Krishna works things out. Thank you very much.